Good afternoon. This is Carol Steckler with Richard Fagan here in the studio. This has been pre-recorded, and we're here today for another chapter, shall we say, in our visits to Antarctica. Good afternoon, Richard. I say good afternoon when it's good morning when we're recording this.
Okay. Hi, Carol. Yeah, it's not only another, I believe it's going to be the last. We're going to have a little bit of a potluck here, an Antarctic potluck.
Okay, well, actually, there's one other pre-recorded one that's going to play in 2 weeks. This isn't the final one.
Well, a technicality. It's the final one that's specifically based in Antarctica.
And then
that's right. Then we're going to do the people close to Antarctica.
But
we're going to actually leave the Antarctic continent today.
You know more than I do because you're the guy that did the research and went there. But I do want to give you a little preview because we have already pre-recorded the last episode, and don't miss it. It's absolutely fascinating, as is this one. And I'll tell you a little bit about Richard again for those of you who may not have tuned in before. Richard is a retired professor from Stanford, and he and his wife Deborah retired here.
It was in 93.
In 93.
Yeah, we have 16 years here now.
Oh, wow. It's been a long time. And he's with us with this wonderful series called This Strange and Wonderful World about places he's been and his own curiosities as he's traveled through the world during his retirement. So he's here because of his great interest in the human experience and what's happening. But he's also here not necessarily as a retired professor from Stanford, but as one of us who has traveled to strange and interesting places. Does that seem pretty accurate, Richard?
Well, flattering. You decide whether it's accurate.
Okay. You're a humble man. You're a humble man. Well, with that, let's hear some about the nutrition during these incredible journeys.
Okay. Before I do that, I want to make just a little transition from the last chat that we had, which was about transantarctic expeditions. And at that time, I mentioned that finally, during the International Geophysical Year in 1957, there was a passage all the way across, an expedition all the way across Antarctica from one side up to the pole and then from the pole down to the other side, highly mechanized, a military operation almost. So that left as a challenge crossing Antarctica unsupported, not with big machines and not with airdrops and things like that. And it was attempted several times. And the first persons to actually do it were two Englishmen by the name of Rand Fines and Mike Stroud. Now, they went unsupported side to side, or at least ice shelf to ice shelf, in 1992-93. We talked about that. So the next challenge, of course, was to do it alone, rather than with two. So enter a fellow, a Norwegian, in the great tradition of Amundsen, of course, by the name of Borge, I believe it's pronounced, Borge or Borge, Ausland. And in the winter of 1996-97, he actually crossed solo. It was an amazing achievement. Not only solo, of course, but completely unsupported. In other words, everything that he ate, drank, lived in, etc., he carried with him from one side to the other. And he started out pulling a sled that weighed 408 pounds, which is, of course, a gigantic load. And he was on skis. He was a very, very fine skier. And he actually averaged 27 miles a day in that difficult terrain. And he crossed. And he was aided, particularly coming from the pole, once he'd reached the pole, going down to the other side, the far side, by using parasails. And That's difficult and dangerous stuff because, of course, there are crevasses and there are huge lumps of ice and things like that. One day, using his parasails, he actually managed 140 miles in 16 hours. It was just really an unbelievable achievement. So he went 1,764 miles using those parasails and his skis. So in a way, that was the last great challenge, because after crossing solo, unsupported, what can you do? I mean, you can, I suppose, the first one-legged person to cross, the first blind person to cross. There's all sorts of firsts possible, but none of them have that same meaning. So what happened after Oslan's crossing was that the adventures turned into a kind of nuttiness. For instance, a year after Oslan crossed, six skydivers attempted to hook up during a free fall over the South Pole. It went disastrously wrong. Three parachutes didn't open. Three landed safely. Three ended up with their unopened chutes going through the polar crust at about 150 miles an hour. So there have, since then, there have been Antarctic marathons. I mean, you name it. It's become a continent which throws up, let's say, artificial challenges, man-made challenges.
You know, an interesting thing that I haven't heard is there are no women who've entered the fray here for the first woman to...
Well, I haven't mentioned it, but of course there are first women.
Oh, okay.
And I had the pleasure of traveling many, many, many times with the first woman who skied to the South Pole. Were a woman by the name of Shirley Metz. And Shirley was one of the founders of Zegram Expeditions, the company for which Deborah and I work. She's the most interesting character, and at least in the early years of our travels, which is to say in the second half of the 1990s, Shirley would show on the expedition a really wonderful slideshow of her trip to the South Pole. She was part of a general commercial expedition. Mm-hmm. She didn't do it solo. She wasn't unsupported, but she was the first woman to ski to the South Pole.
Well, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about Antarctic cuisine, and I chose the word cuisine advisedly. There's a little bit of, hopefully, irony in all of this. Now, when you're in Antarctica, under the conditions certainly of the heroic age of exploration, the early 20th century, and even later, there are three fundamental problems when it comes to the food that you eat. One is that you need lots and lots of calories because it's very cold and you're working very hard. And we'll talk a little bit about what some of the caloric necessities are, but they're well more than double what we would need, let's say, doing a good stint in the garden here on Lopez. There's the problem of nutrition within those calories, particularly getting enough protein and enough fat and enough vitamins to support you in that environment. And the third problem is hydration, which seems at first a little bit counterintuitive, but it's absolutely crucial for two reasons. First of all, this is the driest continent in the world, even though it doesn't look dry when you see the March of the Penguins. There's water all around, but it isn't falling from the sky. It's on the land, and it's very cold. And to get that ice or those snow crystals into yourself for hydration means that you have to melt them, and it takes lots of fuel, and you have to have that fuel with you. The other thing, of course, is that you're working so darn hard that you're sweating all the time, at least while you're working. And that sweat eventually, that moisture that you're throwing off, eventually freezes when you stop the exercise, and then you or your sleeping bag are encased in ice, and you got to get rid of that, etc. So it's a terrible problem. Now, we have some early data on the calories and the composition of the foods used by Scott and Amundsen, and it's actually quite interesting. And we're talking, by the way, about the food that was used once they pushed off from base camp. Because at base camp, the problem is not nearly as serious. You have fuel. You have animal protein nearby in the form of penguins and seals and things like that. But once you start across and you're carrying your own supplies with you, then, of course, the food question becomes absolutely critical. And Scott and his companions basically starved to death. When they died, it was from starvation. Anyway, we know that the rations that Scott carried when they were able to have full rations totaled about 4,400 calories a day. Amundsen was carrying just about the same number of calories, or plan for the same number, about 4,600. There were basically only two sources of these calories in each case. One was something that they usually talk about as biscuits. Biscuits is a form of hardtack. It's a kind of bread that, of course, froze under these conditions, packed with grain. The other thing that they carried with them was pemmican, which was, of course, also frozen. We're going to talk about pemmican later, but that's a source of animal protein and fat. Now, they were getting, in both cases, a little less than 40% of these calories from fat, another 42% from carbohydrates, then about the remaining 20% from protein. When more modern foods came in, and when we were in the era of the 1990s, or even earlier than that, when Fiennes and Stroud crossed Antarctica, they carried more calories, and they also carried them in different form. They had planned, Fiennes and Stroud, for about 5,200 calories per man, per day, and they carried with them large amounts of chocolate, large amounts of butter, and much of the rest was in the form of cereals. They expended on their trip, because you may remember that Stroud was a physician interested in survival, nutrition, things like that, and so they had very, very good measures of caloric intake and use. They were expending around an average of 6,000 calories per day per man, and they peaked out during the hardest effort at 10,000 calories a day. Now, they couldn't and didn't carry enough food to do that. And the body, as I think many of you know, when it's really calorie deprived, will begin to devour itself. It will devour fat, it will devour muscle, it will even take some bone, and it will work on the internal organs. So when Rand Fiennes came out the other side and they were able to measure his body weight after this transantarctic crossing, he'd lost 50 pounds. He was a man weighed of a little over 200 pounds when he started out, a very impressive physical specimen, 6'1 or so, 200 pounds. And he had lost about half of his muscle strength by the time he came out. Now, let's go back. So there you have a comparison in the 4,000 to 5,000 calorie range needed, or even more than that, when you're working out on the ice, hauling these loads, etc. Interestingly enough, but perhaps not too surprisingly, one of the real problems is getting enough of the right vitamins. Because when you're eating that biscuit and when you're eating that pemmican, very few vitamins in it. And this was in the heroic age before the day of vitamin supplements and vitamin pills and things like that. When Shackleton first went to Antarctica, you may remember way back when, he went with Scott. And this was on the Scott expedition from 1901 to 1903. And Shackleton got sick on a push for the pole, and he had to, in fact, be sent back to England on one of the supply ships. And it seems that he was suffering from scurvy, in other words, a lack of vitamin C. Some marine mammals have vitamin C in the flesh, but unless you plan specifically to take in vitamin C, and obviously you can't be carrying your oranges and your grapefruits with you, then scurvy is a real danger. One of the ways in which, on the ships of the time, they, and even earlier, they prevented scurvy was to have people eat sauerkraut, which is actually quite high in vitamin C. In any event, vitamin C is a problem. Other problem is vitamin A, and that works in the other direction. There's a man we haven't mentioned by the name of Douglas Mawson, Sir Douglas Mawson, an Australian, one of the great Antarctic explorers. He went in 1911-1914 on an epic trip. That's the same time that Shackleton was adrift on the ice. And one of his companions went down a crevasse with most of their food when they were coming back. They didn't get to the pole when they were coming back. And he and his remaining companion, in other words, Mawson and one more, were forced to kill and eat their dogs because they were starving and they had used dogs, dog sleds. The companion, by the name of Javier Mertz, died a lingering death from what was later analyzed as vitamin A poisoning. And he was poisoned by the livers of the dogs that they were eating. And evidently the death was quite horrible. So now Mawson is alone trying to make it to the ice shelf, to the base camp, where he hopes he will be picked up. He's also poisoned with vitamin A poisoning. He made it back to this base camp. When he got there, he had dropped from 210 pounds, he was another one of these magnificent physical specimens, to 112 pounds. In other words, he lost about 45% of his body weight. He looked like a concentration camp survivor. He'd lost his hair, and he was near death. Vitamin A poisoning. Let's talk for a moment about hydration. I've already mentioned that it's a very dry place. You have to carry lots of fuel to melt down that snow, etc. And so you need lots of water, and lots of water means lots of fuel, and that means one more thing that you have to carry in large amounts when you're crossing by sledge or man hauling or however you're crossing if you're not being resupplied. But also very critical is the fact that much of this water ends up in your sleeping bag. Again, we're back in the heroic age. And when you get out of your sleeping bag and the body is no longer warming it, the sleeping bag freezes solid. It's just a block of ice. And so there are many stories, gruesome, absolutely gruesome stories, of these folks trying to get into their sleeping bags at night, where they are able to pry open the mouth of the bag about a foot, get their own feet in, and then little by little, over a period of 2, even 3 hours, as the body warms and melts the ice in the bag, they're able to wiggle in. And just about when they're finally down there and getting warm again, it's time to wiggle out, and the darn thing freezes up and they start all over again. So anyway, hydration is a problem. You need lots and lots and lots of fluids. And those fluids really have to come from the snow and the ice around you. Now, protein. I've already mentioned that animal protein is available at the base camps in the form of penguins and seals. There are also whales, but typically they didn't kill and eat the whales. And the whale that was most around the base camps on the edge of the ice is the killer whale. And it was not a whale that they killed and ate. But the penguins and the seals were there, absolutely fearless, unafraid of people. They'd never seen people before, and they were very easy to kill. So penguins were a staple of the diet as long as they were at some kind of a camp. Here's Dr. Bill Wilson. You remember him. He died with Scott on the way back from the South Pole on a penguin called the Adelie, a very sweet little beast. This is Wilson writing. He said, "Stewed, they were delicious, but fried in butter in blessed mouthfuls, they were heavenly." About the emperor penguin, the great pig guy, that's the March of the Penguin, they go to about 90 pounds or so, and will stand, you know, 5 feet tall. When you're standing next to an emperor, you're standing next to a very impressive bird. Anyway, here's Bill Wilson on the emperor. He said, spent the afternoon skinning the emperor, a male, very fat. Half the breast and the liver was a substantial meal for 16 men, with nothing else but some peas, cocoa, and biscuit. We fried it in butter, and it was excellent. Here's Amundsen on the Emperor Penguin, and this is from his diary of his South Pole expedition. And it's typical Amundsen. It's just this laconic style. Man, you know, a good Scandinavian doesn't say very much. He says, an emperor penguin has just come on a visit. Soup kettle. And that's it. Now, penguins were absolutely crucial to Shackleton's men when they were left on Elephant Island. That's the island, you may remember, where the 22 men were left when Shackleton and his companions went off to South Georgia to try and find a way out for his men. And there were lots of penguins there. By the way, the couple times that we've been to Elephant Island, one time we couldn't land at all because these penguins had colonized the only beach where you can land. And one of the things you cannot do on these expeditions is you cannot go into a penguin rookery like that and start, you know, yelling at the birds and chasing the birds and chasing them away. So they had colonized that area. And, of course, without those penguins there, the men on Elephant Island would have died. They would have all starved to death. I've never eaten penguin, needless to say. I have eaten whale on several occasions because when I was in college, you used to be able to, in New England, you used to be able to go to a number of different restaurants in the early 1950s in Massachusetts, and there'd be whale on the menu. And I imagine that there's probably some listeners who've been to Japan or other places where whale is served and whale can be gotten. Not half bad. They look rather good. If I hadn't known it was whale, I might have thought that it was some kind of beef. And they cure it. They cured it because the meat was so abundant off a whale, just by making a sort of 6x6 chunk, let the outside go rancid. That would tenderize the meat inside. It's a little bit like hanging beef. Then they'd cut off the outer part and just cook the inner part. And it was really quite good. Now, I mentioned earlier that I was going to say another word or two about pemmican, because this was an absolute staple of all the early expeditions in the heroic age. It's a Native American word. It comes from the Cree language, and it was used, or made, better said, by quite a few Native Americans, all the way from the Inuits down to the Plain Indians. Its basic ingredients are always rendered fat and dried meat. Could be buffalo meat, it could be seal meat. It didn't make any difference. It was the same thing. The Native Americans often added dried berries to it, which made it actually quite a whole food, because it then contained fat, protein, and sources of vitamins. I have no idea whether they understood that the berries were an essential part of their overall diet and nutrition, but they did it. It probably tasted better with the berries in it. And it's, in addition to its very high food value, of course, pemmican, when properly prepared, will last a very long time without refrigeration. Of course, in Antarctic conditions, it would be frozen, so it would basically last forever. And it has very high in energy and nutritional value for its weight. So it actually makes an excellent food for the trail. We have made pemmican, Deborah and I, at home, taken it on one of the trips to Antarctica, and during cocktail hours served it out. to the horror of the vegetarians and the vegans.
The vegetarians and vegans may be wincing at the stories, let alone tasting it.
And I must say, in these restaurant reviews or these food reviews where you get these points for presentation, I would say that pemmican gets about a 0.05 for presentation. It is not attractive and can't be made attractive. Anyway, here's how we made our pemmican. 3 pounds of unrendered beef fat, which we got from the butcher. I think we got it at the Lopez Market. I'm not sure. Dice it fine and render it in a cast iron pan. Okay? So now you have this fat in liquid form. And if you're a meat eater, actually, that process of rendering smells quite good. It smells a little bit like you have big roast beef in the oven. What you have is a frying pan full of fat. Okay. 2 pounds of beef jerky. We made our own by cutting up round steak. The meat can be rather tough. Doesn't have to be anything fancy. Cut it into thin slices. Marinate the slices in brown sugar and salt. People have different recipes for making jerky. I find many of the recipes just far too salty, terribly salty. And brown sugar and a little bit of salt. Marinate it for, a number of hours, then dry it in a very low oven, as low as the oven will go. Some ovens won't even go low enough. It could be 100 degrees, and it'll do it. Dry it out. It doesn't have to get crispy crunchy. It just nice and dry. Anyway, you pour the liquid rendered fat over the jerky, after you've cut the jerky up into small pieces. And you just allow it to cool at room temperature. And that recipe made about 100 generous pieces when it was cut up, because it's spread out basically in a cookie tin. It looks like, a big plate of fudge or something, except it's not that color. 100 generous pieces, and one piece is guaranteed to raise your bad cholesterol by 20 points. Anyway, we served it out. And I would say 50% of the people were horrified. Another 25% or 30% were sort of game and tasted it. And some of the remainders actually liked it, because it actually, if you're the kind of person that enjoys, well-marbled meat, that it has some of those characteristics, although, of course, it's much, much greasier because it's all of that fat in it. Anyway, so that's pemmican, and up until the advent of freeze-dried food and nutritional bars and power bars and stuff like that, it was a standard food. And not just in Antarctica, but, of course, in the Arctic, and, in fact, other places where people traveled and had to carry food with them. Hoosh, that's the other word that you run across all the time. And I've tried to find out the origins of that word, H-O-O-S-H, used by the British, the word, picked up in other languages too. I haven't been able to find it. Even the Oxford Dictionary, the big guy, doesn't say where the word came from. But anyway, what's hoosh? Well, the problem with this biscuit that they carry that we've been talking about, the pemmican, or just about anything else that you had in your larder at that time, is that it's all frozen solid. And this was true, of course, of people like Stroud and Fiennes, who were carrying sticks of butter and trying to eat as much as a quarter of a pound, in other words, a full stick of butter, every day. And what do you do with this stuff? It's hard as a rock. Well, you cannot afford, in terms of your fuel, you cannot afford to cook these things individually. Basically, everything has to go in the pot, whatever you have. So you melt some water, some snow, that is, into water. And into that water, you throw your pemmican, your butter if you have it, your biscuit, anything you have, the scraps of penguin breath, whatever you're carrying. And you cook it up. And it makes not really a stew. It makes a kind of sloppy mess of some kind. The parts mix together. And that's whoosh. And then you just spoon it up, and that's what you eat three times a day if you're managing to get three meals a day. It's mush, basically, more than stew. And that was the basic meal. That was the cuisine. The others were ingredients. The cuisine was hoosh, three times a day. And I imagine that after time on the trail and being frozen and frostbitten fingers and trying to get your boots off and massage your toes back into life and stuff like that, that as unattractive as the whoosh sounds sitting on Lopez Island this time, it must have been heavenly. Yeah, just heavenly.
Yeah, absolutely. In the field. Absolutely. That's, yeah.
Now, people have asked me, and people on our trips have experienced this, you're bundled up. And I should say parenthetically that on our trips, we never experienced any conditions, even approaching the conditions that the explorers and the adventurers faced. We never were in the kind of bitter cold weather, this 50, 60 degrees below, because we were never very high on the plateau. We had access only to the fringes of Antarctica. The most we would experience that was similar is very high winds. We've been out in winds of maybe 60 knots, which can come very, very suddenly. So there's no even comparing. It shouldn't be in the same breath what modern-day travelers and the real adventurers and explorers faced. But you do, if you spent some time out there, the question is, where and how do you pee, right? Particularly if you're trying to stay hydrated, which you should and you do. You know, you carry water with you, and if you carry water against your body, it won't freeze for the time that you're out. And one of the problems for, not for the age of heroic explorers, but for modern day travelers, is very often you are in a almost a moonscape of snow or rock and snow. So there's no bushes to go by, in effect. And I myself have walked fairly long distances to get over a rise and get away from the rest of the people so as not to be, you know, arrested for indecent behavior, etc. And when we went really deep into the ice on the icebreaker and with the helicopters and things like that, the staff would actually prepare a snow privy, which was just cut out of blocks of snow to make a three-sided enclosure. Obviously, if there was a prevailing wind, you put the open side of the enclosure downwind, and you dig a little pit, and then you have a couple of boards, which you put across a couple more snow blocks, and you have a little privy, and when you leave, you pick up your boards and take them, and you collapse everything back, and it's gone forever into the ice. So it is not a big problem, but it's an issue. And of course, in the heroic age, or for even subsequent explorers, it was an issue very often because the weather was so unbelievably difficult. Now, here's Ralph Fiennes talking about one little experience of his. It's a quote I like very, very much. And this actually did not happen in Antarctica. It happened in Greenland when they were practicing for Antarctica. But it doesn't make any difference because it's basically the same conditions. So here's Fiennes, and I'll close with this. He said, "Cold. My nose cracked for the first time. It's a pity it's so large. On the other hand, while trying to relieve myself just before we set out, I decided that some things would be better larger. With mittens on, it was difficult to locate owing to the overlap of three layers of underwear, top and bottom, two pairs of trousers, and a very long front shirt tail. Owing to the puffy nature of my duvet jacket, I could not see below my chest and did everything by touch. When I thought all was ready, it turned out that my mitt was holding one end of my belt, whereas the offended item, scared by the cold wind, had in fact retreated. This I discovered too late in the day. So it happens even to the greatest of them, because he's certainly one of the greatest. So the moral of the story is that when you're in Antarctica, ladies and gentlemen, if you have an accident, don't be ashamed, because it even happened to Ralph Fiennes.
Who wrote eloquently about it.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Richard, for that very interesting information piece about some of the hardships and how they were overcome by those early travelers as well as the more recent ones. And be sure you tune in it won't be next week. It'll be 2 weeks from when you're hearing this. And can you turn the calendar up? Can you reach that at all?
Yeah,
and
it's I'll give the date. May 4th, I believe, is the Monday.
May 4th is this Monday, and then when is
That's
the
right.
next Monday?
So it would be May 18th.
May 18th. Yeah. Okay, so this is May 4th that you're listening to this pre-recorded broadcast with Richard Fagan on This Strange and Wonderful World. And on May 18th, we're going to have our last program about that. Part of the world, although as Richard pointed out earlier, it's going to be about, Richard, what give us a sentence or two.
Yeah. I thought that it would be useful for, well, two things. It's the, it's the bicentenary of Darwin's birth. He was born in 1809, and he was very, very interested when he went on the voyage of the Beagle to find out something about, to observe and to comment on the people who live down in Tierra del Fuego, who are the folks, the native folks, who live farthest south of any people on Earth. And so closest to Antarctica, but not in Antarctica, because nobody lived there. No native peoples live there. So I thought it would be interesting to do something about Darwin's trip there and about the people themselves, because he had a very interesting take on the people, which says a lot about him, says a lot about the time, and says actually a lot about the people whom he observed.
Well, that'll be very interesting. And tune in on May 18th at about 1:15. And this is KLOILP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And have a lovely afternoon. You'll be listening to some recorded music.